This is Fresh Air. I'm Ken Tucker, critic at large for Entertainment Weekly, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Marshall Herskovitz, along with his producing partner, Edward Zwick, have created such TV shows as 30-something and My So-Called Life. Now, Herskovitz and Zwick are attempting to do for Divorce what My So-Called Life did for Adolescence, that is, deconstruct it in hyper-articulate, microscopic detail. Their new show is called Once and Again and stars Celia Ward and Billy Campbell as suburban parents, one divorced, one separated, who meet cute in a school carpool line and begin dating. The show charts the ups and downs of their relationship, including the insecurities they both have from their failed marriages. In this scene, Ward's character, upset with Campbell's workaholic ways, is asking him why he works so hard.
See, this is what I don't understand about women. They want men to work, to be successful and commanding, and then when men work, they get upset because the men are not available.
You mean I'm not the first person who ever said this? It's not that you work, it's that you all get that man face. Like you become somebody else, and you just can't turn it off.
You're right. I can't.
I just have to ask you, though, is this all my problem, or is there something else going on here that makes you pull away?
I keep feeling like someday I'll get to this place, you know, this safe place where I can slow down. You know, if I can just get the firm to a certain size, a few big clients, take on a new partner.
But are you ever going to get there?
Well, you're not worth much if you fail. I guess that's what I was taught.
But you're nowhere near failing.
Ha. A man is never more than 5 minutes from failing in his soul. 5 seconds. Say something stupid, let somebody scare you, slip on a banana peel, it can all be taken away. Especially when you presume to tell other people what to do.
Marshall Herskovitz, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
It seems on the face of it that this could have been, it might easily have been like a 2-hour feature film. You know, these two people meet, they encounter resistance from their children, their exes, their own instincts, and then they live happily ever after. What made you think of it in terms of a TV series that could go on from week to week?
Well, actually, I take it as a compliment that you see this as potentially having been a film. I mean, you know, Ed and I have always seen ourselves as filmmakers first, and we tend to approach television as if it were a film.
This is your partner, Ed Zwick, that you were referring
to. Yes, yeah. You know, a film that won't stop.
Uh-huh.
We often view production that way, that somehow it just keeps going on and on. That's obviously the downside, but the upside is that you don't have to solve the whole damn thing in 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we just felt there was too much story to tell to really do justice to it in 2 hours. That every little twist and turn of this story, you know, the feelings of everybody involved, all of the different connections that have to be made and broken, just, you know, cried out for a long-term exploration.
And how did you decide to use the idea of talking to the camera? For people who haven't seen the show, you'll see a scene and then you'll cut to a black and white segment where one of the characters will talk about what has just gone on and sort of reveal what he or she may really have been thinking, which can completely contradict what's gone on in the scene before. How did that idea occur to you to use that as a device?
Well, this is one of the great strengths of Ed Zwick, that he thinks about storytelling in very conceptual terms. And after I had written the first act of the pilot, he felt that there was some way in which we were not getting inside the minds of these characters. You know, it's interesting. One of my goals in writing this was to create people who were not as adept at talking about their emotions as the people in 30-something were.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in, you know, the huge section of our population which finds it very difficult to explain how they feel and to in some sense enact that in their relationships. And there was a way in which in the first act I had succeeded too well, and we didn't really feel what was going on behind these people's faces. And you know, Ed suggested this as a technique, And I initially resisted it. You know, it's a technique that really goes very far back. It goes back to the theater in the 20s. Ingmar Bergman has done it. Woody Allen's done it. Rob Reiner's done it. It's a form of narration, finally. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a form of first-person narrative. It's just it's using the camera, whereas we're used to hearing it and not seeing it. It's really very much the same as, you know, opening a book and having it say, "Call me Ishmael."
Mm-hmm.
And I tried it and was instantly won over. It just gave us so many opportunities to go inside these people. And we found a way using these interviews to see, to reveal how complicated a person's thought processes are, even as they're in the midst of living and interacting with other people.
At what point in the life of a series do you and the writers start moving away from whatever initial ideas you had about the characters in theory and start writing for particular actors as you begin to understand their strengths and limitations?
That's a really good question. You know, it is inevitable. It happens pretty early on, as I see it. It certainly happened already on our show. I think pretty much once you go into production, it doesn't really happen on the pilot. It happens once the series goes into production and you are with the actors, you know, day after day, week after week, and influenced by them, not by what they say to you, but by the work they do and by who they are. You know, each of these actors has changed the characters in ways they never intended to and we never foresaw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some more than others. I would say that Julia Whalen, who plays Grace, the teenage daughter of Celia Ward, has had an enormous impact on her character.
Mm-hmm. In what sense?
Well, you know, we wrote Grace as a pretty dark character, you know, a very troubled girl who has a real problem with self-image, who, you know, has a lot of anxieties, and we intended for some real conflict to emerge with her mother and in her life based on that. And we cast this young girl who is such an astonishing actress, but who we discovered in life is so full of joy and life and connection. And there's just a light in her eyes that is so remarkable and unforgettable that we just find ourselves, you know, sort of taking this slightly different path with mm-hmm. Grace. She's still troubled, but she's got this humor and this energy that's slowly beginning to emerge. Interestingly, you know, one of the criticisms, you know, that have been leveled at the show is that people are often annoyed by Grace. They say, you know, she whines too much. She, you know, she's too negative. She's always angry. I think that was the original conception of the character, and I think had we not found Julia, that criticism might have been even stronger. But I think as time goes by and you see the effects of how she has changed the character, I think those criticisms will diminish because that's not who the girl is.
Mm-hmm. Talking about Julia Whalen, there's a scene in which the children are spending the weekend with their father, Celia Ward's ex, and she becomes very annoyed when suddenly a girlfriend of the father's shows up. Is that right?
Correct, yes. Yeah.
I think it's what you're talking about, the way that character expresses her frustration, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. I find those scenes to be very delicious. The woman who plays the girlfriend, his name is Ever Carradine. She's quite wonderful and very charming. But also very young, and I think the kids are just a bit horrified at seeing their father with this beautiful young woman, and Grace, the character that Julia plays, is I would say pretty unstinting in her criticism of her father.
Let's hear a little bit from that.
I love small food.
Me too.
Baby carrots, tater tots, those little teeny tiny corn cobs, shrimp. So anyway, the radio station where I work is doing this big promotional thing on Sunday.
Like a party?
Oh, definite party. And we're giving out free t-shirts, you know, get people aware.
Aware of what?
So they'll listen to that station, like bribery. Exactly.
We used to listen to the radio on the way to school, but But our mom won't let us anymore. She says it's offensive.
Oh, yeah. Mainstream radio is so sickening. The whole morning show thing is fully out of hand.
But yet you work at a radio station.
That's pretty hypocritical, huh?
Grace, don't your food go to waste again.
It's just miniature food.
That's a scene from Once and Again. We're talking to the show's co-producer, Marshall Herskovitz. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking to Marshall Herskovitz, co-creator and co-executive producer of Once and Again. Marshall Herskovitz, do you look at shows like Felicity and Dawson's Creek and know that they wouldn't exist without My So-Called Life?
Oh, boy, you'd never get me to agree to a question like that.
Well,
the most I'll say is that, you know, a lot of people claim they were ahead of their time in various moments in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And often that covers up the fact that they, you know, couldn't make something succeed. I think we do have some kind of proof objectively in the world that My So-Called Life was ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can remember a phone conversation with Bob Iger we had when we were begging the network to pick up the show for a second season, where we actually said to him, Bob, you know, demographically, the show doesn't serve you because the main audience for the show is teenage girls, and that's of no interest to you economically. But these people have no voice in the culture. And if you could see the letters and the emails we get from these people, you would see that we are really doing good work in the culture, and you're not losing money on this show. You should keep it on the air as corporate good works. That's literally what we said to Bob Iger, and this is only 4 years ago.
And what did he do? Laugh in your face?
No, he was actually quite moved by that. I think that, you know, the politics of that particular moment were very complicated. And I've spoken about this openly before. It's not a secret that Claire was very interested in moving on and doing other things in her life. Remember mm-hmm. that in order to do the first 19 episodes of My So-Called Life, it took us almost 2 years. The network never supported the show. They would pick it up in dribs and drabs, you know, six episodes at a time. And she was already 16 years old. She had started when she was 13. And
we're talking about Claire Danes.
Claire Danes, yeah. And she wanted to move on with her life. And, you know, I didn't want to be in the position of filing suit against the 16-year-old to compel her to work on my show, and neither did the network.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll never know. My guess is that the network would have reluctantly picked us up for another 13 episodes if Claire had not stated her desire to move on elsewhere. But I don't think the fate of the show would have been that different, because I think the network and the audiences at that time weren't quite ready yet. I think we were a year away from people being really interested in the inner life of a 15-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm. To go back to Once and Again, how long can this courtship last? We see this kind of giddy romance taking shape. We're watching them date. We watch this kind of furtive liaisons that Billy Campbell and Celia Ward have. How long do you think realistically the audience will accept this kind of billing and cooing?
Do I detect the most gently veiled criticism?
No, not at all. I'm interested in from a kind of, you know, how you see the arc of the series going.
It's already changing. I mean, you know, maybe there was one episode's worth of wish fulfillment on the producer's part that we keep that billing and cooing going.
Uh-huh.
You know, certainly people have said to us, you know, when are we going to learn more about the other characters? When are they going to stop, you know, sneaking around to have sex? That's already changing. It's been changing in the last couple of weeks. And you know, lots of stuff will happen, none of which can I speak about now in any real specific way.
Right.
But I think we really wanted to lay the groundwork. There are many competing needs in telling stories like this. We want to do justice to this relationship between these two people and the development of it, but we also want to do justice to all the people around them. This is finally going to be an ensemble show, and we will have Eli stories and Grace stories and Karen stories. You know, it's not just going to always be the Rick and Lily show.
Mm-hmm.
But we needed to lay that groundwork, and already it's beginning to spread out. Now we're beginning to have stories about the children and the ex-spouses. It's going to be quite a large tapestry, finally. And we are slowly but very surely moving in that direction.
This seemed to me to summarize the kinds of criticism your shows have gotten over the years, and I sort of wanted you to respond to it. It's a piece that Greil Marcus wrote recently. I don't know if you saw an interview. It was about 30-something.
No.
And he said, the show featured the most irritating characters in the history of the medium, yet it was possible to tune in every week with empathy and fascination, wondering if the junior ad man could make even more of an ass of himself, parentheses, yes, if his wife could be more superior, parentheses, to be sure, if the permanently tenured professor could be more self-ennobling, he says yes, and he says, the whining remains the sign of authenticity, thus allowing viewers to see themselves as heroes. And then he concludes by saying, hey, I never missed a week of this show. I mean, is this typical of the kind of things you've heard over the years about your shows?
Oh, God, yes.
That seemed to summarize the kind of reaction that people had. I mean, I know people who watch your shows who feel the same way, that they are at once irritated yet completely fascinated by them.
This has been the most mysterious part of the last 12 years, is why the people who hate our shows so much can't just not watch them.
Mm-hmm.
This has been very amusing to us, occasionally painful, but mostly just bemusing. We just don't quite know what to make of it.
Well, do you take it as a compliment that you're writing, that the writing and the acting is so compelling that people feel, you know, they can't keep away from these characters?
You know, I'd like to say I take it as a compliment, but I, you know, there's a part of me that says that, you know, if I did it really well, then they wouldn't find them annoying.
Uh-huh.
You know, I do believe, by the way, in my experience of life, everybody whines and complains. They just do it in private. They don't want to be seen as people who whine and complain. And I think the things people get most exercised about are usually so inconsequential, in their lives, you know, who didn't call who back, or, you know, or any number of things that people constantly worry about and get themselves all upset about that are not cosmic in nature. It's just very painful and embarrassing for people to think that that's how they're going to be seen. So I think that was part of the annoyance, but I think probably, you know, these characters were, I think, had a certain entitlement to talk about themselves that most people don't feel, at least in public, in their lives. And I think that was annoying. And you know, I take responsibility for that.
Let's talk time periods.
Yes.
ABC put you in the NYPD Blue Tuesday nights at 10 spot to launch the show. And there's this big recent kerfuffle when ABC said, maybe we'll leave you there. And the way it was portrayed in the media, it looked as if Stephen Botchko went ballistic, got on the phone, talked to the media, got stirred up a lot of resentment among the public who wanted to see their NYPD Blue back. And you guys were kind of silent during all this. What was going on with you and Ed Zwick while Botchko was raising this protest?
The truth is, not a whole lot was going on. You know, we have had many, many discussions with the executives at ABC since they picked us up in May. And, you know, they wanted us to be reassured all along that they were going to take our show very seriously and that there were many options available to them. You know, Stephen is very ferocious in the defense of his shows. And you know, I'm not going to criticize him for that.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't really have a beef with him, and he didn't have a beef with us. We both wanted the same time period. It wasn't really either of our decision. So he fought in the way he needed to fight for his show. It's pretty clear to me that, you know, that going to the press and whipping up that frenzy didn't really have much to do with ABC's decision, because I was talking to them all during that time. You know, their main concern was what's going to happen, you know, after we find places for all these shows. Are they going to do well or are they not going to do well? Mm-hmm. They weren't particularly concerned with the, with, you know, how upset, you know, a bunch of journalists were at that point, because mm-hmm. you know, I don't think the audience really cared at all, frankly. I think they found a solution, and the solution is that we're going to stay on Tuesday nights at 10 until January, and then because of a bunch of there's a bunch of programming upevals in January anyway, so it was
after
a convenient time.
Ends.
There's a preemption early in January. So basically, what will happen is on January 11th, NYPD Blue will come back Tuesday nights at 10 and take over that time period. We'll be off the air for a couple of weeks, and then on January, I think it's the 24th, Monday, we will start Monday nights at 10 o'clock, and that'll be our new time slot, at least until the end of the year.
Well, Marshall Herskovitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with me.
Thank you.
That's TV producer Marshall Herskovitz. His new show is called Once and Again, seen Tuesdays at 10 on ABC. I'm Ken Tucker, and this is Fresh Air.